Good evening. This is Paul Kelly, and I'm welcoming you to today's segment of Speak Up Arkansas. The U.S. Constitution applies a series of checks and balances through the creation of three branches of government: the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. These branches are there to protect our country from the tyranny that comes from the concentration of too much power in the hands of a few. We hold these branches accountable through the voting process by examining their individual actions, their votes on critical issues of concern to us, their public statements, their campaign promises, the people they surround themselves with, and those who contribute to their campaigns. If we watch closely, we already see that the executive and legislative branches are vulnerable to the influence of the rich and powerful. The justice system is often looked to as the final determinant of what is right and what is wrong. It is critical to our democracy. It touts itself as a defender of rational and fair treatment under the rule of law. But it too is under suspicion. So what can be done to uphold the public confidence in this valued branch of government? How do we hold our judges accountable now, and what might be done in the future? In the studio today are people who think about this and are willing to share their perspectives and answer your questions. I try to avoid circumstances when I'm surrounded by lawyers, but I very much appreciate each of them taking the time to join me today. After all, it's their profession that we count on to ensure that the democracy we seek in this country is protected and clear. In the studio with me today is Tony Hilliard, who is the recently elected president of the Arkansas Bar Association, who is in private practice in Pine Bluff. Tony, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And David Sakhar. Do I say that right, David?
It's Sacker, like a grocery Sacker. Would have been a great middle linebacker name,
All right, David Sacker. He is the executive director of the Judicial Discipline and Disabilities Commission. Tim Dudley, a practicing attorney here in Little Rock, serves on the board of the American Foundation for Judicial Accountability. And joining us later is Little Rock attorney Scott Tanner, who has proposed measures to address how judges are elected and confront the issue of dark money in election. He'll be joining us by phone from Colorado later in the program. So I think it's best to start with you, David. I know the Judicial Discipline and Disabilities Commission is the place where people turn to with concerns about problems with judges and with the system. So tell the audience about what your agency does or doesn't do, kind of the history of it, and just share with us all of that.
Sure. The JDDC is a watchdog agency for the judiciary in the state of Arkansas. Basically, we handle ethical complaints against judges, Arkansas state judges. We obviously don't have jurisdiction over a federal judge, or sometimes one of the things that people get confused about, county judges, because they're really executives. They're really like a mayor of a county. It's going to have to be a judicial branch judge that we have responsibility over investigating. Our mission is to protect the public while maintaining the balance of an independent judiciary, as you've been talking about in your introductory remarks. We're not here to look over the shoulder of a judge and second-guess their decisions. Right. However, there's ethical standards that we are here to investigate and hold them to, and that can be on the bench, off the bench, political activity, things like that. The commission was created by a constitutional amendment, which makes us really independent. A lot of other states have a commission, Judicial Conduct Commission, that is created by Supreme Court. So they work for the Supreme Court. We are created by an initiated constitutional amendment by the people. which is about as grassroots as you can get. The people decided they wanted judicial accountability in the late 80s and passed a constitutional amendment. From there, we have 18 members, basically a full commission, three judges, three lawyers, three normal people, citizens. And we have a mirror alternate panel. Now, the alternate panel's actually is actually where most of the work's being done now, because we have two tiers. When a complaint comes in, the alternates are in three panels, one judge, one lawyer, one layperson, and they investigate like a grand jury. So they decide whether to charge a judge, whether to issue a subpoena. They kind of drive the investigation. Once they do, if they decide to publicly charge a judge with ethical charges, then it becomes public and it goes in front of the nine other members who have not already had a chance to review. So it's a little more due process protection.
All right.
You know, as far as what we do, you know, our canons are pretty simple. The general principle would be the do right rule. You know, the first canon is obey the law, including the ethical code. So they, if you violate anything, you violated the first rule for sure. Uphold the integrity of the judiciary and don't use your office for personal gain. And these are all things that we've seen in the past in corruption cases and things that bother the public. And those are standards that we deal with judges. Canon two involves all on the bench behavior, like judges getting their job done on time, being courteous. We have demeanor complaints. Whether a judge should recuse from a case, which can usually be an appeal issue, should a judge stay on this case or not, but there are times where it can cross over into judicial ethics issues, things like that. And then the third canon would be, what does a judge do in their off time? Are there business connections tying them up too much? Some of the things we're concerned about with Citizens United and the third branch becoming too politicized are very real fears. But we also have canons in place already that say a judge shouldn't be involved in businesses that could cause a lot of recusal or cause a lot of people to think they're not fair. Also goes to criminal behavior, as we've seen recently. Actually, yesterday, we've had a busy day yesterday with a judge who we charged with ethical charges, and then he was charged with a felony later in the day. So I'm sure some of your listeners have heard about that. And then the fourth canon has to do with politics. What can a judge do or say in being involved in endorsing other candidates? And there's a lot of First Amendment headbutting in Canon 4, and quite honestly, judicial conduct commissions don't win a lot of those on the higher level. So that's been an interesting thing to experience over the last decade. I've been at JDDC for 10 years, the director for about five. And I was a trial lawyer and a prosecutor before then. So it's been an interesting metamorphosis to see how much the canons and the rules have been challenged by judges on First Amendment issues.
Huh. Okay. I want to remind listeners that if you have a question, you can email us at speakupar@gmail.com, and I will present that question to the panel that's here today. And again, later in the program, we'll be opening up the phones for calls, but right now we're going to be just getting sort of a summary from the guest, and then we'll move on to any other questions you might have. So, Tony, I know you're now in a position to have influence and obviously are respected by your colleagues in the state as president, I guess is the title, for the Arkansas Bar Association. First, congratulations, and again, thank you for being here. Talk a little bit about how this issue of judicial accountability affects the bar and what your suggestions may be for helping the public understand and appreciate and actually monitor this on their own. I know you have some ideas about that.
Well, one of the things in particular I want to point out is David was talking about, we have the Arkansas Code of Judicial Conduct, which has been a very effective manner to police and deal with those kind of issues with the judiciary, with judges. And so I've been extremely proud of the judges that we've got in Arkansas and how well they've done. And I think the world of them, frankly. I also go back to the kind of things, it was funny, right before the show came on, there was a an advertisement. Somebody was talking about the goals of repealing Citizens United. I find it real interesting that the U.S. Supreme Court, after Citizens United, in a case called William Uley v. Florida Bar, in that case, they saw judicial campaigns as being one of those rare exceptions where free speech takes a backstage to that strict scrutiny requirements of acting as a judge and the campaigns for judges, and we can put those kind of restrictions on those campaigns. So we really do see there's an opportunity there to try to back off some of the dark money. One of the other things that I think is very important for your listeners and for everyone else, and what I've noticed, is that there really should be more voter participation in knowing who the judicial candidates are, getting to meet them, getting to know them. One of the things we're going to be trying very hard this year within the Arkansas Bar, within the local bar associations, is trying to have forums for judicial candidates where they can be heard and be met by the public on equal footing, whether we do it with the local Rotary Club and the local Bar Association, the County Bar Association. Either way, I think those kind of things are critical to making an effective campaign, as well as much as possible to override the impact of that negative money. It really concerns me that too often in any political campaign, we the voters too often have just sat back and let the advertisements or the local TV station tell us who to vote for. That's a huge mistake. We need to be active and involved in that voter process, in that process of selecting the judiciary or any other political candidate.
Uh-huh. And are there any programs or services or things that the bar participates in or sponsors that helps bring the code, the ethical code, and this issue before them on a regular basis?
Before the judges or before the voters?
Well, I guess either.
Well, we don't so much bring the code of judicial conduct in front of the typical voter. We are involved, as I said, on local levels, trying to put the candidates in front of the voters. At the same time, I think lawyers do see that importance of that, following those judicial ethics. And the judges, and we do hold our judges accountable to them, and they have done we've seen the impact when judges don't follow. David has had several high-profile cases that he's prosecuted and worked with and removed justices from the bench because of that. And so, frankly, those are clear indications that the process works.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, I was looking at the from your website, David, just to see some of the data, because I'm a data person.
Yes,
and
sir.
I see that I had a question here. It
sure
looked like under the source of complaints, it says Circuit Court 182. Who is that? Someone in the court, or who? Where did that complaint? The complaints come from?
I mean, I could be wrong, but I think that means the type of judge that was complained against.
Okay.
We get about 250 complaints a year, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. It's never really varied very much, surprisingly.
Right.
And you're going to get probably more of them from Circuit Court because they handle child custody and some criminal, which people are going to get more emotional about and even make complaints that we can't handle. They don't understand the system, and so they file complaints that we can't handle. But you can understand why they do, because it's such an emotional situation.
Right.
There are some data in there that, for instance, we'll show you who filed complaints, and you'll see that lawyers are very low. It's very
right.
rare
There's
that
only
a lawyer.
Six of them on this one.
Right.
Yeah.
I think lawyers, first of all, the Arkansas Bar generally understands. They understand what happened and that it's just part of the system, whereas the average citizen might feel something worse happened. So right. Mr. Dudley doesn't file a complaint because he knows that was just a ruling that maybe he disagreed with, and it's not anything to complain about ethically. The second part is obviously some lawyers are intimidated, and they're worried, if I complain against a judge, you know, will that be come out against me? It doesn't have to be very obvious, but you know, you don't want to do that. And I think that's probably true as well.
Well, the reason I brought that up, because I understand here that litigants mm-hmm. are obviously a major source of the complaint.
Sure, including those in the penitentiary.
Right, right.
You can imagine we get a lot of just, you know, letters from prison about things we can't do. You asked me earlier. We can't adjust a sentence. We can't get you a new judge. We can't change your child custody. If you're dissatisfied with the result, you have lawyers and you have appeals. Unless there was an ethical issue, unless the judge was somehow not supposed to even be on the case, was corrupt, something like that.
Right.
I'm always available. I talk to citizens all the time, and you know, I'm not trying to shirk my responsibility. I just don't have that authority.
Right.
So I try to point them in the direction of someone who could help them, whether it's legal aid, access to justice, or other lawyers.
Right.
And the Bar
okay.
Association is great about, they have a referral service, and I've sent many people over there. And very proud of the work the Arkansas Bar does, and making sure that people, if they can find a lawyer in their area, and I'm from Rosebud, so I understand small towns.
Uh-huh.
It's not easy to find a lawyer in some corners of the state, and the
right.
Bar really tries hard to find people lawyers that they can afford.
All right. Well, Tim, I've got in front of me the guiding principles of the American Foundation for Judicial Accountability, and I know that you really believe that judicial excellence can only be achieved through some accountability. And talk to us about what the American Foundation for Judicial Accountability is doing in this regard.
And let me give you a little bit of background for the foundation. Many years ago, and when I say many, probably 30 or more years ago, the Arkansas Bar Association did an annual survey of lawyers who rated judges. And those results were published every year. Judges who didn't get good ratings didn't like it. And they managed to put an end to it. So for over 30 years, there's been no organization that rates judges and makes that information available to the public. For federal judges, there is an outfit that does an annual survey of lawyers and publishes a book which basically rates every federal judge in the United States. Sam Peroni, who is a local lawyer, decided that he would like to establish a foundation to provide information to the public about judges and how they perform and how good or bad their integrity is. So he established the American Foundation for Judicial Accountability. Our purpose is to get information to the public that people who vote for judges can use in determining whether or not they want to vote for a particular judge, and also to litigants who are going to appear in front of that judge so that they can do the research and find out what other litigants and lawyers say about the judge. To do that, we have a website. It's www.judicialrating.com. Anybody who has appeared in front of a judge or any lawyer who has appeared in front of a judge can go to that website and rate the judge. And there is a list of questions which a litigant or a lawyer answers. And the questions include things such as, was the judge courteous to everybody in the courtroom? Did the judge appear to have knowledge of the law? Did it appear that the judge had read the pleadings and the briefs submitted by the lawyers? Did the judge appear to favor one side or another, either a criminal or a civil case? So, and there are more, but those are the nature of the questions. And each question is rated from 1, which is very poor, to 5, which is very high. Let me also stress that the results are the ratings that are submitted are strictly confidential. Even the board members don't see those. I couldn't tell you who gave a rating. In fact, I couldn't tell you anybody who has given a rating because we're not privy to that information. That information is available only to the administrator, and he's sworn to secrecy. So no one has to worry about retribution from a judge if they go online and give a rating. I think this is at least a start on giving the public information that's available nowhere else. There's nowhere you can go to find out what lawyers think about judges or what litigants who have appeared in front of lawyers think about judges. So I think this is a good start on holding judges accountable. And I would stress that this is not a place just to come and complain about a judge.
Right.
We get very favorable ratings for judges. And it's important that the public know that. I mean, if you got a good judge, go on there and tell everybody you got a good judge. If you got a bad one, get on there and tell them you got a bad one.
Uh-huh. I know every time I get on the phone to deal with something, I always have to take a survey at the end of it, and I go get my car fixed, and they send me a thing asking me how it ought to go, how it went. I guess you're relying basically on public information in order to promote this website. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So how long have y'all been in existence?
I believe the first year we were open and available for rating was 2 years ago. So a year and a half to 2 years.
All right. All right.
I'll have to admit, I'm glad the Arkansas Bar doesn't do judicial ratings. One of the things that concerns me anytime I see something like this are, one, sometimes judges have to make unpopular decisions, and they do so. And if that, you know, if everyone says an unpopular decision where they're going and looking at the law versus what the populist view is at that point, then there's a real good chance they're going to start getting some very unfavorable ratings. At the same time, you look at issues where the most likely person to respond on a voluntary situation like that is the person that's the most upset. When you get mad about something, by golly, I'm going to go after them. And Tim, maybe that's not y'all's experience, but those are the kind of things that I worry about when I look at those at that type of rating of judiciary. I know right now you'll see political groups trying to do that same kind of rating of the judiciary. You've got some conservative groups taking the idea, oh golly, that judge is an activist judge, and here we're rating all of their rulings based on those kind of evaluation. That's completely different than what Tim's doing. But I see those kind of things as being a challenge to the validity of the judiciary. I see some comments by some of our political leaders about, oh golly, these judges are just biased or whatever. And when you start putting those attacks on them without just because they ruled in a manner that's against what you think is right, we've got a challenge there. I think we need to be looking at our judges as applying the law, whether I like the law or not. I look at some of the things that our statewide newspaper has written about some of the judges, and it deeply, deeply concerns me. It concerns me because they're trying to tell those judges, golly, you know, you don't have the intelligence to be a judge, and I disagree with that paper completely.
Well, but those are not, you restrict your people to folks who were actually in the courtroom, right? The plaintiffs, the...
That is our rules. Now, if somebody wants to get, we don't, like I say, we don't monitor who gets on there. Uh-huh. If somebody wants to get on there just to rate a judge they've never been in front of, they can do it. But let me respond quickly to what Tony said. I agree with him. There are certainly folks who are going to get on there because they got a bad result and give the judge a bad rating. The flip side of that is, where does the public go to get information? Where do the public go to get information about judges, whether or not they want to vote for them, whether or not they've got good judicial temperament? There's nowhere to go. So I'm not saying we have something perfect, but we got something better than anybody else has got right now.
And that's, you consider, a weak spot in our accountability process.
Sure, but that's going to be true in any survey you do in any area of business or law. Uh-huh. I mean, the federal system relies solely on lawyers, and I promise you there are some lawyers out there who rate judges just because they don't like them very good or because they ruled against them several times. Uh-huh. I mean, that is a problem with the system, but like I say, where else are you going to go to get the information?
Uh-huh. I think that's really important, even, and I'll be right in the middle here on this, is that, and Tim, forgive me if I'm incorrect, you have some safeguards, like they have to have a case number or something when they enter a rating. I saw something when you started it. So at least to try to keep people from just getting on there and flooding right. One judge with negative. So they're trying to get empirical evidence the best they can. Right. And of course, you know, the president of the bar is correct. You could wind up with a lot of politics or the bar criticizing judges for political reasons. But in other states, my agency, and trust me, I'm not asking for more work, they will be charged with writing factual bios for each candidate. We don't even have that. Wouldn't it be nice that when we had an election that an independent agency who has to write with journalistic, you know, type ethics as far as just what we know about this person, not opinion, they've tried this many jury trials, they've done this, they've been in practice this long, things that they've done and accomplished.
Lost on appeals.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, cases that they had, boards they've been on, and at least you'd have it coming from someone other than a political consultant.
Right.
And trying to keep our third branch from being, the third branch is the only branch that's not supposed to be promising results to you. You run for president and you say, I'm going to be biased this way. You run, if you're a senator in Detroit, you're probably pro-automotive, right? Right. If you're, you know, so, but the judges are supposed to be right up the middle. And like Mr. Dudley says, there's not a lot of information. People vote on judges kind of like a popularity contest. So we got to be careful about, on one hand, like Mr. President here said, we can't have too much criticism against them just because. But on the other hand, we've got to have some information for the public, so I think that the answer's in the middle.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
I've got a question about, and I don't understand it. We've got the right people that are explaining to me why the situation is the way it is. There was a judge who ruled on a nursing home case. I think the nursing home in question was in Greenbrier, and a jury awarded, I think, like $5.3 million or something like that to the plaintiffs for a lady that was ordered by her doctor to go to the hospital and the nursing home didn't take her there.
Yeah, we're familiar with that one.
Yeah, so what I don't understand, now the judge has been convicted of a crime and is going to prison. However, the plaintiffs, I think, then turned around and tried to sue the judge and the former senator and possibly the nursing home owner that was funding political campaign contributions for that judge who was going to run for, I think, the appeals court or something like
right,
that.
Right.
It was ruled that the judge couldn't be held or couldn't be a part of the lawsuit because he was acting in a official capacity. And I don't understand that because if a police officer, you know, is, for example, is acting in an official capacity and somehow or another violates someone's rights, maybe shoots them or something like that, they can be sued. So I don't understand why that is a valid reason when the judge is found guilty of misconduct in a case like that, why that judge can't be sued in the civil.
All right. Well, I think we're about to answer that. Thank you for the call again, and I think we'll get off the air and let David handle this. I also think, I don't know that anything was done to the person who actually made the contribution.
No, the case is still being investigated. Of course, we're not involved in the criminal matters. We would turn stuff like that over and work with the federal government like we have in several cases. But the question's an excellent question, and it's hard for the public to understand because we get taught stuff like judicial immunity in law school, and we take it for granted that we don't want judges looking over their shoulder going, boy, if I make that ruling, I could get sued, because otherwise we know people would sue judges all the time. On the other hand, this is a case where judicial immunity was taken to the extreme, because it seems, and I've got to say, I agree with the caller, it's not an official duty of the judge to take a bribe. You know, it's official duty of him to reduce a verdict if that's what he believes is correct. But when the corruption came in, the judge made a ruling probably based on the letter of the law, and it may very well be supported, that judicial immunity is that broad. That's the reason why judges are protected more, so that they're not chilled. You don't want a judge who makes the correct ruling on an awful case that would be tragic, but it's the right thing to do to let somebody go, let's say, worried about being sued. On the other hand, in this case, it just shows, well, is that truly part of his duties, or shouldn't that have been allowed because it was outside of his duties? I think that's what will be litigated in this case. I know all the lawyers involved, they're excellent. The judge involved that made that ruling is excellent. I've tried jury trials in front of him and lost them too. I imagine it'll go up on appeal and we'll get a good answer as to, does judicial immunity go that far as to protect a judge who is convicted of bribery?
All right. We have a email question. Where are the weak spots in the system that need to be strengthened to protect it from lack of independence and corruption?
Well, let me try that. One of the weak spots, in my opinion, and this is probably going to raise a lot of discussion, but in Arkansas, we elect judges. Electing judges makes or has the potential of making judges beholden to those who support them, both politically and monetarily. Frankly, I think the federal system is much better. Appointed judges do not have that problem. So that's one of the problems we have, I see. As far as corruption goes, let me say this. There are lots of judges that I don't think are very good judges, frankly. But corruption is not a big problem in Arkansas. I've had many, many clients say, who paid the judge off? Well, you know, Judge Maggio is the only judge I can think of that's ever been convicted of that, and the only judge I can think of that's ever been accused of that. Corruption just doesn't happen in the sense of a judge get paid off. If you want to say corruption is, does a judge play favorite with some lawyers? Yes, that happens. Does a judge play favorite with local residents of the county versus out-of-county residents? Yes, that happens. I don't view that as corruption, though. I view that as part of the problem with electing judges.
I would disagree with the part about the electing judges. I heard when the Bar Association was looking at that question, do we go with, you know, start pushing for appointment of the Supreme Court versus elected, there was a comment made that one of the real challenges within when we start looking at the judiciary is how many times is the general public directly involved in the court system? For the average law-abiding citizen, the only times that they get involved in the court system, in the judicial system, is either voting for that judge or serving on a jury. And we're starting to see jury trials fading fast from a lot of things happening there that I think are a problem. I do think if you say that the problem is we aren't getting the right people to run for judge, then that's just a matter of us going out and recruiting them and saying, hey, we need to let's look at who should be getting to run for the judges. But the problem when you get into appointing the judges, heck, we had the U.S. Supreme Court, the appointment was held off for, what, a year? A year because it was so politicized. And they said, well, let's just see who gets elected president. So from that very point, I see it's still getting politicized.
Hello, you're on the air.
Well, hey, this is Scott Ryder calling in. How's it going?
Hey,
Scott.
Well,
hello, Scott.
You been listening?
I just barely got tuned in a few minutes ago.
All right.
Say I've listened to the whole program.
Right. Well, welcome. We're glad to have you here. I know you've been taking some actions and making proposals to deal with this issue, and would like for you to share with the listening audience your perspective on all of this.
Yeah, has anyone by chance covered the idea of a recusal by a judge, you know, when a judge should not decide a case because of a conflict of interest?
No, not really.
Is that something that would be in keeping with the subject of this whole call?
I think so.
Okay. Well, I thought I might just bring that up because I do think that that's a part of holding members of the judiciary accountable. Right now, in our rules of the court and our law, there is no clear procedure. If you've got a trial judge that you think might have a conflict, there's not a clear procedure and a set of rules to tell an attorney how to challenge that judge and ask the judge to recuse. Now, that sort of thing does happen where that request is made, but you don't. If the judge refuses to recuse, then the case just goes forward, and you don't have any way to take an appeal of that decision right away. The case just goes forward, even though you think that the judge on your case may have a conflict of interest. And it's only after that judge decides the case that you would then be entitled to take an appeal. And yet the judge has already decided the case. And so if you take it up on appeal and the court agrees that the judge should have recused and stepped off the case, well, then it has to go back down to be assigned to another judge, and then you have to go through the whole trial again. So some of us had devised some proposed rule changes that would allow the attorneys involved in a case to go ahead and take a quick appeal if a judge had refused to recuse and step off the case. So that was one rule change that we had suggested, and another one has to do with the Supreme Court itself, because there, if someone alleges that a justice on the Supreme Court in Arkansas has a conflict, then that individual justice makes the decision on whether to step aside from the case or not. And if that justice says, no, I'm not going to step aside, I don't think I have a conflict, then there's no way to have any review of that by the other justices. And so some of us felt like that the other justices at that point ought to be able to review and determine if the first justice should have stepped off the case or not because of a conflict. But we presented those through the Arkansas Bar Association to the Arkansas Supreme Court, but they did not act on those proposals. And so I just would submit to you that in the future I'm still going to try to help bring about that type of change, because I do think that, you know, having proper review and timely review of whether a judge should recuse or not is appropriate procedure that we should have in our state, and all attorneys ought to know the rules of the game.
I think Scott has some very interesting issues, and Scott, this is David Sacker. I testified or spoke in front of the bar committee when they were considering.
You all still there?
Yes.
Yeah, can you not hear us?
No, I couldn't hear you, sorry.
Okay. Well, I'll turn them up and see what happens.
Okay.
Can you hear me, Scott?
We got a lot of noise. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine, friend.
All right, this is David Sacker.
Paul.
When I testified in front of the, or spoke in front of the bar committee, we spoke about the very issue.
Dude, I still can't hear anyone else.
Oh, goodness. Try it now.
We need an interpreter or something.
We talked about the very issue that
Scott. Can you hear him now?
Not a word.
Oh, Scott, can you hear me?
Hey, Scott, can you hear me now?
I barely heard that.
Now?
Yeah.
All right, this is David Sacker.
Oh, David, okay, I can hear you now. That's great.
Yeah, thank you very much. I had to borrow a different mic. So.
Okay, cool.
I've got a face for radio, but I must not have a thing for radio. Radio must not like me. But anyway, we talked about that in front of the committee, as you remember, which is kind of the Tennessee rule that allows for what the public would probably not know, but an interlocutory appeal, which means you can appeal while the case is ongoing. Of course, that increases, you know, your appellate load, but others believe that it doesn't. Most lawyers won't do it unless they really need to. There's another thing that we mentioned, which is Texas's model, which is where another judge on the trial court bench can rule on it. So at least the public feels like another judge looked at it, that it wasn't just myself calling myself fair and saying that's the end and you don't get another say so. I agree with you that there's going to be some continued reform efforts on that. And, you know, all I've done is present the information. You know, here's different ideas. I know that y'all are looking at it. I'm not going to be too critical of any of them except to point out the positives and negatives from both sides. As far as Supreme Court justices go, I understand what you're saying, except, hey, that's what we've got up in D.C. I mean, we've got Clarence Thomas's wife being involved in things that are directly involved in appeals, and yet he stays on. You don't get to tell Clarence Thomas he has to, you know, recuse off of a case, and he was just as appointed as the other ones, just as our Supreme Court justices here were just as elected as these. So I think those are going to be challenges in the future, but I definitely thought that your efforts were good, academic, been in practice in other areas, so there's a lot of background there. And I'm sure people like Mr. Dudley, who try a lot of cases, come across this issue more of, hey, I don't want to spend all the money on a case and then have it go all the way up, win my appeal on recusal, then I got to try it again. I'd rather know right now whether I'm going to win.
Would you like to say anything?
Yeah,
I hear you.
You can hear me?
Can you hear Tim?
I'm not hearing anyone else right now, though.
Hi, Scott, this is Tim Dudley.
Hey.
I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I would add that I think we expect too much of judges when we ask them to decide themselves on whether they should recuse or not. Judges are human like everybody else, and most judges think they can be fair, like all of us think that we can be fair. So I agree that the Tennessee solution is probably better and that a different judge should decide a recusal motion. I like your idea on the Supreme Court or appellate courts, except that the other judges on that court are not likely to order a judge to recuse. My suggestion would be that you have some kind of independent commission set up, made up of other judges, circuit court judges, or lawyers, who would decide recusal motions for appellate judges.
Yeah, and that, of course, that gives you another layer of committee or bureaucracy, you know, which I could see may or may not work efficiently. But I know when I attended a little course recently at the Rose Law Firm, where former Chief Justice Howard Brill was making a presentation on various ethical issues about the court. He brought up this whole subject, and he was actually on the court when they had an opportunity to consider the new rule that I just described a few minutes ago, and they didn't take any action on it. But he said words to the effect that the way it works now is if one or more of the other justices thinks that a fellow justice should in fact recuse, then what happens is that you walk down the hallway and knock on the door and go in there and visit with that justice and say, hey, I really think you ought to recuse, you know. And that, he said, well, you know, maybe that's about as far as we could go, but you know, you never know. That all would happen in secret. You'd have no record of it. You'd have no idea if one or more justices wanted the other to recuse. And so we were trying to think of some way to have a formal process where someone other than just the one judge, you know, got to review the decision on whether to get off the case, for instance, for a conflict of interest.
All right. Scott, I have a question from a listener. Well, what about influence? For example, the contributions from certain groups and individuals who may be sued a lot. How to protect from influence that comes from contributions and elections? How do we do that?
I can say one thing quick.
That was a topic that we discussed a whole lot, too, when we had this task force to consider various rule revisions. And I, you know, helped provide information to the task force on that subject. And for one thing, we pointed out that in the old rule, which existed up until recently, the judges were supposed to try to make sure they didn't know who their contributors were. But we felt like that was really, I don't want to say a sham, but we just think that there was no way to have a judge not know who some of his or her contributors were. Because, you know, they have fundraisers and the judge is expected to show up, and there are all these people walking in the door, and some of them are going over to a table and writing a check and putting it in a jar or a basket, and then in about a minute they're walking over there and shaking hands with the judge, you know. So yeah, I think that there are many instances where a judge would have an idea of who the contributors were. And so we did get the court to agree to just end that prohibition on judges not knowing who the contributors are. So now they can know who their contributors are. And why is that important? I think it's important because if someone wants to challenge a judge as having a conflict of interest because of contributions to that judge, then that becomes all out in the open, because the judge is free to know who the contributors are. And then a party who wants to challenge that judge's objectivity can freely present a motion saying, look at all these heavy contributors that you got that in some ways may be related to the decision in this case, and therefore we want you to recuse.
Scott David would like to say something.
Okay.
Scott, one thing that I think is, we talk about a lot of the problems here, but let me mention one of the solutions, something that's just happened in the last year. Representative Jana De La Rosa has been pushing for this, and I was fortunate enough to be asked by her to testify in support a bill for transparency on the contribution website. And it basically, we were having people file once a month. They could do it by fax, by scan. There was no real good way to sort and know who was supporting that judge. And if we're going to ask for recusal motions, we need to know right away and go, look, this judge just got thousands of dollars from one industry. I want them to recuse. Well, that law got passed, and now it's going to be mandatory that elected officials, including judges, and I testified it's most important for judges because they're supposed to be neutral, to know who's contributed towards them, and now I can sort it. You know, I think I even said it was easier for me to find other online gamers than it was for me to know how much the forestry industry had given to a judge, and that's unfortunate. It shouldn't be that way. Thankfully, De La Rosa got that bill through, and it's a big step in making sure the public and attorneys and litigants know immediately who's supporting that judge and whether they want to challenge that.
Boy, I agree with you 100%, and I'm glad she got that bill through. She didn't get it through the first session 2 years ago, but she did get it through this year, and I agree. You know, it just goes to show that all of us are concerned about this, or, you know, able to make some progress, and Representative De La Rosa is to be commended for sticking to that.
Absolutely.
Okay, Scott. Well, I appreciate you. I hate to say this, but I'd like for you to kind of sum something up, because I'd like to allow we're a one line operation here. So
yeah.
So, but would you, if you make some just short closing comments, we could go ahead and open up the phone for other listeners.
That makes sense to me, and I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person to participate more fully. But anyway. Thank you for inviting me, and I think that the people that you invited to be on the program are all very well versed on this, and I'm encouraged that with some of the comments they gave in reaction to mine, I think we're all wanting to have the system be more open and hold judges accountable and do it under reasonable rules, and we still got a ways to go, but we have made some progress.
All right. Well, thank you again. I envy your low humidity, low temperature out there in the mountains of Colorado, and I wish you could send it through the airways, but enjoy yourself, and thank you for being a part of this.
It was really hot today. The high was 71.
Ah. All right.
And thank you for including me. Bye-bye.
All right. Goodbye.
Take care, Scott.
So anybody want to... Well, first, I want to remind callers we've got 10 more minutes. We'd love to have any questions you have. This is an important topic. You know, I'm somebody who works a whole lot. My background is in juvenile justice. And, you know, when I think about the justice system, I'm just so aware that it is low-income minority people going to prison. And, you know, the judges are one part of that. But... that is what I think, too, contributes to some of the frustration, particularly in my listening audience, about the over-incarceration of people thinking that in fact, is going to be the solution to the problem. Tony, yeah.
I'll agree completely. The fact that we have underfunded our public defenders is a crisis. The fact is... if you've got a good lawyer on your side, your opportunity to win is better. That's just a fact. We've got public defenders who are excellent, excellent, but when you look at their caseload, it is ridiculous. Heck, in New Orleans, now this is outside of Arkansas, but in New Orleans, the public defender's office have said they're not taking any more cases. In fact, they've sued the state to try to force funding so they can have that access to justice by all. In the civil courts, I know one of the things that we have with Central Arkansas Legal Services, and in particular the work that Amy Johnson's doing with Access to Justice, we're seeing a much more concerted effort. But by the same token, when you look at the Central Arkansas Legal Services and most of the lawyers that are on staff to provide that, they're hitting maybe 15,000 people as clients.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, hello. You're on the air.
Excellent topic today. Can I put my 2 cents in?
Yep. I mean, you can put a nickel in. We got enough time.
Well, it won't even be that much, but I'm going to fix something really basic. We're talking about crime, and we're talking about, you made the comment about lower-income people and being incarcerated and so forth. I'm going to go something real basic, and I challenge any scholar to research this for me. When divorce rates start dropping, crime will stop dropping. We got too many fatherless kids out there. We've got too many young men growing up with all the wrong influences, no parental support, no child support, and so forth. And I'm 54, and I could have been one of them. But my vow in life was not to be the man my father was, and was to support my children. And my wife will be married 31 years this next week. And I want to tell you, you know, you that song about it's I beg your pardon, I never promise you a rose garden. Well, even a rose has thorns. Marriage is sometimes rocky and sticky, but that's my 2 cents. I'll hang up and listen. You guys keep it up, okay?
Right. Well, thank you.
Thank
for
you.
That.
Thank you, sir.
I agree. My wife's a Methodist preacher, so
right.
I agree.
I'm a preacher's kid. I will say this, though. Honestly, the divorce rate has way declined since the 80s. It's a surprising statistic. Most people still think the divorce rate is 50%, and it's not. It doesn't mean that what the caller's saying is not true, that there are issues in the family, whether divorce rate is part of it or a major part of it or not. Certainly, we have kids that, no matter what adults do in America, every kid deserves to be fed. Every kid deserves to have a chance and an opportunity. And that's an area where the justice system can do better. And I think we see people like Amy Johnson, the Bar Association, and others trying really hard to do that, because there's no excuse for not allowing kids to have an opportunity to grow up, make their choices.
And I think it's also very important in how divorces are handled. If when it is contentious and there's no real effort to reconcile, and men are pushed away from their families, or, you know, I mean, that I've been in divorce hearings too, and they can get very, very nasty and that sort of thing. And I wish the system could take a little more, and I know there are where you try to compromise.
Mediations.
That's right.
Yeah, one of the issues as we start looking at this, again, for the poor and their ability to afford legal services, I wrote an article here recently where I bemoaned the fact that one of my friends at my Rotary Club, every time we say the Pledge of Allegiance as we end with liberty and justice for all, he turns to me and says, that can afford it.
Right.
And I just cringe at that. And yet, one of the challenges you've got on the national level is that the President Trump's budget that's been proposed to Congress completely eliminates funding for the Legal Services Corporation, which is where you get the people that are providing the services through Central Arkansas Legal and through Amy Johnson's work on access to justice. We've got to find ways, and one of the ways that we're looking on that one that does not involve money is some of the rule changes where we allow lawyers to give limited representation, where they help people through the system to a degree without being there with them the whole time through the trial. And that's one of the ways that we can deal with the enormous workload for those folks that can't afford legal representation.
Right. Well, again, I'm going to tout juvenile justice, because that's my, I've been doing that for 20 years. But that system knows it needs to change, and we need to have leadership. And that leadership to do that, because the people who are affected by this are not feeling empowered about it. And so we need folks, and I think, in fact, the judiciary have led, like the Judge Testy in Georgia, who has led an effort to reduce the incarceration of nonviolent, low-level offenders, and we're decades behind in Arkansas. Tim, I want you, you've been sitting over there. I always want to talk to the silent one. What's on your mind?
Well, The issue we've been talking about is really a societal issue, not particularly a judicial issue. Although I will say, when it comes to things like blacks getting the death penalty much more often than whites, that's not a judge problem. It's a prosecutor problem. It's a prosecutor who decides whether or not to seek the death penalty. And I don't understand why prosecutors seek the death penalty much more often against blacks than they do against whites for the same crime. Right. And I'm not sure what we do about it. The elections is the only way I know of, at least in Arkansas, to change prosecutors. So
Right. Go
vote.
Right. Well, and I'm trying to be objective or remove myself a bit, but I know darn good and well that the people in power who are subject to prosecution, you take, for example, one person went to prison for what happened during the financial crisis. One person went to prison, and we're sending tens of thousands of people to prison for stealing, you know, small amounts of money. And why is that? But I know there are a lot of lawyers working on that, and I get my information from a lawyer. I got relatives who are lawyers. My dad was a lawyer. I'm not bashing them. I'm just saying, yes, it's a societal issue, but it has to do with something in the judicial system. Again, that is why it is so revered, I think, and why you mentioned earlier about it ought to be treated different than politicians. There ought to be a higher standard. That really has to happen, and I think the public has that. And I think that this is frightening to people because they are concerned that this system is not, that something may be happening there. And that's really the reason I brought you all on, because that's what I'm hearing from my listeners. They're concerned about that. It really, they are affected more than anybody else. And they see what's happening in other places.
Yeah, George Washington said the judiciary is the firmest pillar of our government, that it is the place where we all know when it comes down to it, whether I'm Democrat, Republican, black, white, someone's going to view me fairly and make a decision, win, lose, or draw. And when we lose confidence in that, it really shakes the system. Now, I'll say this after 10 years of investigating judges, I've got more confidence in the judges that we have. I think they're getting better. Doesn't mean we don't have bad ones out there that we have to eliminate. But, you know, we're asking people to get elected by 50% plus one and then make a ruling for 1 or 2% and protect a minority. We need that independence. We need to protect that independence and have transparency. It's just hard to do.
And some of the best developments and steps forward in this country have come from the judiciary.
So absolutely.
I thank all of you all for being here. I really enjoyed the conversation. Tony Hiller, for the president of the Bar Association. David Sacker, the executive director of Judicial Discipline and Disabilities. And Tim Dudley, who serves on the board of the Arkansas Foundation for Judicial Accountability. Next week, we'll be talking about education. We're going to have the new president of the Arkansas Education Association. It's not too early to start talking again about education. I want to thank you for listening and invite you, if you have an issue that you want discussed, that you want me to talk about and bring people in about, please send me an email at speakupar@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to Speak Up Arkansas. We'll be back next week.
Hi, this is Alanis Morissette, and you're listening to KABF 88.3 in Little Rock, the voice of the people.
It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we'll share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, Chewing the Fat with Rex and Paul, interviews with some of your favorite musical artists on Arkansas Sounds, content from the Butler Center's collections, information about what's happening in the library system, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear.